I don't need to remind you that it's been well over 30 years since Pol Pot declared year zero and the Khmer Rouge began slaughtering the Cambodian people. Took the lives of 1.7 million, left another 5 million horribly affected, and various attempts to bring the Cambodian killers to justice fell by the wayside. Pol Pot himself, of course, died without ever having to face up to his crimes. And in the meantime, in this tiny, devastated country, millions have just been quietly trying to rebuild their lives. Last week, the Khmer Rouge were back in the headlines after the UN tribunal found a former leader, Comrade Doi, guilty of war crimes, sentenced him to 19 years in prison. That sentence got a mixed reaction from the survivors, and tonight we're talking to one of them. Thierry Seng, as I told you, is a lawyer and author who was born in Cambodia. She was seven when both her parents were murdered. She grew up in the US and in 1995 returned to Cambodia, where she's been working to get reparation for the victims of that country's Holocaust. Thierry, welcome to our little program.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
I think it's important for you to share a bit of your life story with us. Your father, your dad, was a military officer in the army of the then head of state, Lon Nol. You think he was executed in prison, but you've never been able to find a record of his death?
I really don't know exactly where my father was killed. I believe he was killed at Do Slang, the torture center that was just in the headlines under the direction of Doi. But he could have been killed elsewhere. And I was 4 years old. He was killed right away when Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge took over the capital in 1975. Yes, I really don't know where he was killed.
But you do know where your mother was killed, of course, because you were there. Your mother and your brothers were put into a prison by the KR. Tell us what you remember of that.
I was 7 years old then. We had been living under the Khmer Rouge regime for 3 years now. We were in a prison. We were in a detention center in the heart of the Eastern Zone bordering Vietnam. And, of course, the Khmer Rouge was officially at war with Vietnam, and we were in a province bordering that. So it was where all the purges were happening. And in the prison where we were detained, 30,000 were killed, including my mom. And that night, I was with my mom, but for whatever reason, there was a strand of compassion amidst the pure insanity. The Khmer Rouge prison guards wanted to preserve us children. We were the only children, and in hindsight, I really believe they wanted to preserve our lives, and they did. They killed the whole prison population, totaling 30,000 over however many months, including my mom. But that night, they killed my mom, but they let the children, my four brothers and I, lived. And they freed us the next morning after having killed my mom and the whole prison and population that night.
I find it very impressive that you can... You refuse to see the KR entirely as monsters, as entirely insane, that they did have a degree of compassion.
We have to. I mean, even though we use these words of to describe them as monsters, at the end of the day, we have to believe that they were human, and they are human, because then we can hold them accountable. And it's also a reminder of what we as human beings can do to each other, not just the Khmer Rouge, when we're given the right conditions. And as we need to remember, the Khmer Rouge emerged in the Cold War period. There were carpet bombing by the United States, which radicalized these peasants, illiterate peasants in the countryside.
This is the great contribution of Henry Kissinger.
The contribution of Henry Kissinger and then President Nixon, yes. So we have to understand that when all those factors mixed together, it imploded and exploded into what is now known as the Khmer Rouge. But it's a very humbling reminder for us human beings that these monsters were and are human beings, are like us, And it's a reminder of what we and the human and what human nature and what we can do to each other as human beings. So it's really we can only hold these individuals accountable when they are human beings and not monsters and not aliens and not all these other words, superlatives we use to describe them, but at the end of the day, they are human beings.
And that same view, of course, has to be taken of those who perpetrated other genocides, including a very famous one in Europe. I'm talking to Tiari Seng, and she's talking to me from, I should have said, from Cambodia. You miraculously survive, you become a refugee, you end up in the US. Did you think about Cambodia when you were living there, or did you try to distance it as far as you could from your memory?
I didn't have an awakening to the larger Cambodian experience until college. Up until college, I was really struggling with the demons from within. It was a very linear personal experience. College opened my eyes to Cambodia and the larger picture of Cambodia and my personal experience in that larger picture. But I have to say, you know, when we went to the United States, it was a double whammy. We were at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder as refugees, and it was double trauma. We were still dealing with our past, and the past caught up with us, and we were put and thrown into a new culture at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder. So you can imagine the trauma and the compoundment of issues and emotions which accompanied me in my early years and in particularly in my teenage years. But I have to say that I didn't really have the wherewithal, I didn't have the tools to think of Cambodia larger outside of my personal experience, which was very limited to the emotional turmoil and the demons very much still within myself, which I had to purge. And that was a long process, and hopefully I have purged a lot of those demons out of me to be able to really come back and confront my past and help others to confront their past. But it was a long journey of healing, a long journey of self-discovery, and now I'm back here and I'm still on that journey, but hopefully with a little bit more tools to deal with it and for myself and also to help others along as well.
Tiari, let's go back a few stages in that journey. When you went back in 95, the country was still completely unworkable, wasn't it? There was no toilets, no running water, no roads. And your first impression was at the airport where you were assailed by hundreds of beggars.
I had hundreds of hands reaching out and at me. Dirty, young children begging and screaming and grabbing my purse and you know, everything and begging for money. And they were right there at the very gate of when I landed off the airport. And I have to say, I was so emotional that I just broke down and cried, and I just cried for the next 1 week straight through. And the organization that sponsored me there wanted to ship me right back to America, thinking that I wasn't going to make it. But I have to say, in hindsight, I'm glad I allowed all those emotions, or as much as possible, to flow out of me. Because then it allowed me fresh air and fresh energy to deal with the work and the volunteer work that was before me for that year and a half. But the Cambodia in 1995 was still a war zone. All the scars of war were very, very much there. The capital city had no paved roads. I left Cambodia in 1979 as a refugee. I came back, and the place still looked the same. It was as if there was a wrinkle in time, and everything was frozen in time, whereas I had experienced, you know, New York, Los Angeles, Paris, and the States and modern living, and then all of a sudden, I'm snapped back into my home country, which was a war zone, and it was still a war zone in 1995.
One of the wrinkles in time had many of the leaders, the KR leaders, still living in Cambodia, alongside the people whose families they'd killed. And there was a pretty half-hearted attempt, wasn't there, at the time, by the government and international courts to bring them to trial?
Well, we have to understand that it was Cold War politics that that brought the Khmer Rouge to power, and it was Cold War politics which maintained their power until 1991, when Cold War ended, and the powers in the region were more diversified and diluted. So it's not surprising that they were, even though they were pushed to the border and their regime ended in 1979, they were still a powerful force who wreaked havoc in the country, especially along the Thai-Cambodian border, aided by China, aided by the United States, aided by the Western country, aided by Thailand in terms of giving physical refuge, and they were given a seat in the United Nations. So the Khmer Rouge and during their reign of 4 years was a product of the Cold War and, of course, of other things as well. We need to claim responsibility for it, we meaning Cambodians. But then they stayed in power and had some power and continued to wreak havoc because, again, of Cold War politics, and China versus Soviet, the West versus the Soviet bloc, and then, of course, ASEAN nations and wanting to stem the tide of communism. So we were very much a pawn. Cambodia was a pawn of Cold War politics, and the Khmer Rouge continued to be in power and continued to have some sort of power, in particular a seat at the United Nations, because of Cold War politics.
I remember it vividly and with great abhorrence. Now, you gave back to Cambodia for good in 2002, and this is one of the most extraordinary parts of your story. You meet the man who was responsible for your parents' murder and whom you hold responsible for the nearly 2 million people killed by the KR, Brother Number Five. You met him. You spoke to him for an hour. How did you control your anger?
It was such a surreal moment. It's the most surreal moment of my life, and I'm still relatively young, I guess. But I can't imagine any other moments which will surpass this. I basically met the former head of state of the Khmer Rouge, Khieu Somphan, who is now in detention waiting and trial by the Khmer Rouge Tribunal. And I met him when he was still free, living freely among the perpetrators at his home. And I was training on democracy in that region. And the night before, randomly, someone asked me whether I wanted to meet him. Of course, I jumped at the opportunity. And then I met him. And when I first saw him, there was this initial loss of breath because he looked like someone I knew so well. And of course I knew him from all the photographs and all the images which have been haunting my mind and which are so familiar to me from the public record. But then of course I've never met him. That was the first time that I saw him. And then he gave me an hour and a half, and he at the end he really wanted to prolong the conversation, but of course I had to go back and drive through remote region, which were 2 hours away, so I really had to be strict in cutting off the conversation. But it was so surreal, and I have to say, I met him as an adult. It was 2002. I was already 30 something. And I knew I had moral authority. I looked him straight in the eyes. At one point, or one or twice, he couldn't meet my gaze because the conversation was such where the whole time I had moral authority and I felt it and I knew it.
Forgive me for interrupting, but it's important to understand that he conducted himself, as you say, politely, grandfatherly, and charmingly.
And calmingly, I mean, it was very emotional, but I wasn't ranting, I wasn't screaming at him, I wasn't accusatory. I wasn't overtly accusatory. I really wanted to prolong the conversation. I didn't use the occasion as a grandstanding moment. I really, really wanted to have a conversation with him because I wanted to hear him talk, and I didn't want him to cut off the conversation and kick me out of his house. So it was very emotional. I mean, there were moments where, I mean, tears were streaming down my eyes. And again, and he tried to, at that moment in time, he tried to tell me a funny story of his time in Lyon. But there was another moment where he could not meet my eyes, and he had engaged, and he had to look outside the window. But it was calm. I was calm. I felt calm because I knew I had all the authority on my side in terms of moral authority, in terms of justice of it all. And again, I was there as an adult. I wasn't fearful of him, really.
Okay. Well, that moral authority has sort of given you great strength. So let's now move onto the current situation and the recent trial. The government of Cambodia, under Hun Sen, have said that they will only try four more KR leaders, which happens to be all they have in custody. And as you point out, they've stonewalled the UN tribunal along the way to even the current trial. What the hell is going on? Explain that to me.
Yeah, so this is the fear. The fear is that the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, first of all, is the product of a political compromise. It is the product of the lowest common denominator between the United Nations and Cambodia. It took 10 years to establish the agreement and to establish this court. Because this current regime of Hun Sen never ever wanted this Khmer Rouge, because they themselves were former Khmer Rouge cadres of some rank. This current government is littered with former Khmer Rouge cadres, including the prime minister of some rank. And they defected to Vietnam, which ultimately came with the force and invaded Cambodia. They defected not out of ideology. They defected because they feared being the next purge. So currently, we have five individuals who have been detained, divided into two cases. Dut, which is of Dos Lang, and the director of Dos Lang in prison. But Dos Lang is only one of 200 detention centers during the Khmer Rouge years. And Chiang Ai, the killing field where people were disposed of, is only one killing field among 10,000 killing fields. And Dut is only, we have to remember, he is not a senior Khmer Rouge leader.
Could he be deployed at the next trials as a witness against them? Does that perhaps account for his very short jail term?
Yes, I think this is one of the reasons that is given and that could be explained for the short verdict of only 19 years as a sentence effectively, because he will be the star witness in the next case involving the four senior Khmer Rouge leaders, which we fear the trial may not even happen, because again this current regime has been blocking and delaying on the second case, which is really the heart of the matter. And of course they have overtly blocked in case 003 and case 004, and when the UN prosecutor wanted to prosecute six more additional individuals, five or six more. But right now we're not even sure that we're going to have case 002, because these men are old. They're in the 80s and they're in poor health. And if the government doesn't want it, there may be political interest which may help to expedite their death as well. So this is the fear, that we may be left only with case 001 involving Dutch, whose sentence was given last week of only 19 years, and we don't want him to be the sole scapegoat. And this is a concern, that he may be the sole scapegoat of this murderous regime where 1.7 million lives were taken, including my parents.
Thierry, I understand that you observe that many people in Cambodia are indifferent or don't seem to be concerned about this process. But surely that's because of a collective amnesia, a desire not to be reminded.
Well, I would rephrase it. I don't think that they're indifferent. I think they're very cynical of the political process and the judicial process. And also, I think they're not indifferent, but they're overwhelmed with a sea of very urgent, important problems. This is one important issue among a load of important issues that are confronting them, and more of them more urgent and more present and more immediate. For example, they have to deal with trafficking of human beings. They have to deal with land grabbing, land evictions. They have to deal with and just basic survival needs. One-third of 14 million, 4 to 5 million people are living under 50 cents a day, 50 U.S. cents a day in 2010. So I think I would just clarify in saying that they're not indifferent. It's just that they're overwhelmed with more immediate concerns that are vying for their attention.
But Tia Reeve, we've got to wrap.
Also very growing.
We've got to wrap it up because I find, look, we could talk all night, and I wish we could. It's a great honour to have had you on the program, Tia Reeve Singh. Tia Reeve is a lawyer, an activist, and an author, deeply involved in the ongoing fight to get justice for KR victims in Cambodia. LNL, ABC Radio National, etc. The bad characters in the AIF.